Blog Talk Radio.
Hour for July 1st, 2010. I'm your host, Polk Runyon, and tonight we have a lecture on the Hermetic Kabbalah. And we said in the abstract that first we would define what Kabbalah or QBL is, and then we'll present a very simplified version of the basic principles, sort of a Kabbalah for dummies. And then we'll move on into what we can do with it. And I said that was the fun part. And I once said that hypnosis is the tactic of the magician, and Kabbalah is his strategy. We'll define Kabbalah as a software program, an operating system, or a schematic for the mind, which enables the left brain, that's the rational part, to access and control the right brain, which is the intuitive part. And then we'll get down to the magical nuts and bolts. We'll define the four dimensions and the tree of life, the cube of space, and what the astrological connection is, and where the angels and the demons live, and how we can use Kabbalah to communicate with them. So I ended up and I said, tune in and let us gently bend your mind. Now, I don't think Kabbalah has to be a mind bender. I think we can at least get you to grasp the fundamentals of it, and I think that's a doable thing. So, first, let's talk a little bit about the history of it. How it got started and what it is and how it got started. Kabbalah is a mystical philosophy that puts the universe together and explains creation and explains the process of creation all the way from the highest level all the way down to what goes on here on Earth, and it is. It is so well structured that you can use it for mystical, magical purposes. This is the thing that makes it so attractive to magicians is the fact that it's kind of a road map to the astral plane and planes beyond that, and so it gives you an operating system. Now, it got started, according to myth and legend, according to the Jewish interpretation of it, Moses received it from God as the esoteric key to the Torah. The Golden Dawn came up with the idea, or they got the idea, that it had been given by God to Adam, and they proceeded on that idea. Truth of the matter probably is a little further down the line than that. Kabbalah got started, as near as we can tell, in Alexandria, around about the same time that the Hermetic tradition got started, and of course that's the two have interpenetrated ever since. But it got started as an outgrowth of a Jewish form of Gnosticism called Merkaba mysticism. Now, Merkaba means the throne. And what this was that the Jewish mystics would go into a trance and they would ascend up to the throne of God, and they would, you know, would sit at the feet of God. This was called throne mysticism or common mysticism. Well, it evolved out of that. And Gnosticism, of course, as I think we all kind of know what that idea was, the Father God way off across the abyss sends the messenger, that's the Christ or the Paraclete, and he gives you the message that the Holy Ghost is inside you, and you need to go back to the Father and get off the planet and get out of the clutch of the demiurge who is ruling the physical world and all that. That was Gnosticism, and it was developed, you know, around that time. And of course, the Jews had a large community in Alexandria, and they had their form of Merkava mysticism. And so, Neoplatonism and Hermetic philosophy and these various, and Pythagorean Greek philosophy, all kind of merged into this Jewish form of mysticism they were starting to develop. Now, it didn't really pop up in any form that we can recognize until about 300 A.D., and a little book came out called the Sefer Yetzirah. Now, the Sefer means book, and Yetzirah means formation. So this was the Book of Formation. It was a little book, but a very, very important little book, because it gave the names of the Hebrew, of the planets and in relation to the Hebrew letters, and the signs of the zodiac in relation to the Hebrew letters, and the elements, at least three of them, in relation to the Hebrew letters. And so what you had here was the beginning of this practical mystical philosophy that we eventually ended up calling the Kabbalah, is because of the alphabet. Now, this was an idea, by the way, the Hebrews got from the Greeks. The Greeks were the first ones that started applying new numbers and astrological correspondences to the letters of their alphabet. Valentinian Gnosticism and Marcus and the rest of them were doing that. And that influenced the Sefer Yetzirah. And the Sefer Yetzirah, this little book, has the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and they're attributed to the seven planets, the three elements, fire, water, and air. And they didn't have a letter for Earth. That was a little problem there. And they ended up making Tau, the last letter of the alphabet, that had to serve as Earth, and it also served as Saturn. Now, there's some interesting things that they did with that, but so you had the three mother letters, they had the letters for the planets, and then you had the 12 letters for the signs of the zodiac, and that made up 22 letters. Now you could use these in permutations and formulas and magical names of power. So this is the real start of the Jewish Kabbalah. Now, so it doesn't pop up again, at least as near as we can trace it, until over in Spain, around about the 1200s, and there was a book called The Sefer Bahir. And that went building on the Sefer Yetzirah, and it talked about a secret tree, a tree design. And it was expanding on the Sefer Yetzirah. And then this is what really, really got the Kabbalah going. A fellow by the name of Moshe de Leon, around about 100 years after the Bahir, and of course the Sefer Yetzirah was already there, in Spain, Moshe came up with a book which he claimed he got from an old Aramaic manuscript from the 2nd century. Aramaic, as you probably know, is the predecessor for both Arabic and Hebrew. So he claimed he had this old Aramaic manuscript by this mystical rabbi, Ben Yochai, who lived back in the 2nd century, and he produced a book, a Kabbalistic treatise, called the Zohar. That was the Book of Splendor. Now, this thing was just, it went on and on and on. It was, there were several things about the Zohar. It was a mystical commentary on the Pentateuch, but it had other aspects, too. A lot of astrological magic, which I think he picked up from Picatrix and one thing or another. And the secret heart of it, which has only recently come to the light of those who didn't know, was the Song of Solomon, the Shir Hashirim. But anyway, the Zohar became the key work of the Kabbalah at that point. Now, this is about 1280. Now, it's interesting to note that Moshe de Leon was copying these books out and selling them as fast as he could, and he was actually making his living selling copies of his Zohar. A very wealthy rabbi over in Italy corresponded with him, had a copy of it, and wanted to come over and visit him, but by the time he got over to Spain, Moshe was dead. So he visited the Moshe's widow and his daughter and said, you know, you people are poor, and he didn't have anything, and I'll buy that Aramaic manuscript from you I'll give you enough money to where you two can live in comfort for the rest of your lives. But both the widow and the daughter had to admit that Daddy made it up. So the Zohar was Moshe's creation, but it's a marvelous, marvelous thing, and it was picked up by Isaac Luria, the greatest of the Kabbalists, a few hundred years later, and he based his system on the Zohar. So and later on, the Golden Dawn, of course, used a Christian or European version of it, the Kabbalah de Nodata, three books from the Zohar, and a lot of their Kabbalah is based on that. Now, the point here we need to make is this, did it remain a primarily Jewish system? Well, it did for the Jews, yeah, they kept it up until about 1700, and sometime in the 1700s, the Jewish philosopher Maimonides said, "Oh, we got to get rid of this. This is just holding Judaism back, you know. And this is the age of the rationalists, and we can't have this. We got to concentrate on law and philosophy, and should put this behind us." But the Kabbalah had already gotten loose, and the Hermetics and the Rosicrucians had picked it up, and they had done their own version of it. And so the point that I'm making here is that by the time the Golden Dawn got started in the 1880s, there were as many non-Jewish people practicing the Hermetic Rosicrucian version of Kabbalah as there were Jewish people practicing the rabbinical version. So it became an almost a universal system, biblical-based universal system. And the Hermetic Kabbalah differs in several respects from the Rabbinical Kabbalah, because the Hermetic Kabbalah adopted tarot cards and applied them to the paths of the Tree of Life around about 1850-1860, under the influence of Paulus Stanislaus de Gaudia and the great Eliphas Levi. They were the ones who decided to put the tarot cards onto the Kabbalah. And Eliphas Levi actually believed, and Paul Case believed it too, that the tarot preceded the Kabbalah. Now, that's not true, but that's what they believed. The Hermetic Kabbalah, the Kabbalah that we practice outside of the rabbinical circles, tarot cards do have quite an influence. They have an influence on the paths, not so much in the spheres, but of the Tree of Life. Now, there also, too, there's something about the Hermetic Kabbalah that should be mentioned. It uses or employs more practical magic in a more open sense than the rabbinical Kabbalah does. In other words, the Hermetic Kabbalah applies quite often Egyptian god forms and in our case Canaanite god forms right onto the tree, and right onto the spheres of the tree. And also we use elementals, and we use an amalgam of angels, elementals, and pagan gods and goddesses. Now, of course, in the rabbinical Kabbalah and in the more strict version of the Christian Kabbalah, and there's not too much of that, by the way, you would use just the angels. You wouldn't deal with Egyptian or Canaanite god forms. Now, the rabbis came up with a concept, dualistic concept they called the Klephoth, and they put a tree of evil down below the tree of good, supposedly. Let's talk about this tree for a minute. The tree design, the one that we're all familiar with, it was developed by a Christian mystic, Athanasius Kircher, around about 15 in the 1500s. This particular design is the one that we're all familiar with today, the one that the BOTA uses. By the way, the artwork that we had over on the website, that's Builders of the Adenim's little tree. We should give them credit for it. They're a very good Kabbalah school and a very good Tarot Kabbalah school, Hermetic school. The tree that we use is Kircher's tree. Now, there were many, many, many other configurations of trees. Isaac Luria came up with a whole bunch of them. And I want to point out that there is an 11-sphere tree for inner order work. And the Golden Dawn has one, we have one, and Isaac Luria had a number of them. These are 11-sphere trees, and these are supposedly trees before the fall. I'll get into that later. Now, all of this comes down to a design, a schematic, if you will, with these 10 or maybe 11 spheres that actually have different characteristics. They're applied to different planets. They're applied to applied to different dimensions. And they're like, well, Rigardi once described them as filing cabinets, but I think that's only the crudest definition of it, because they're a lot more than filing cabinets. They're the spirit of the various things that apply to that particular sphere, that planet, that force, that aspect. Now, the way the Tree of Life and the Kabbalah works is that way up in the top, you have this higher dimension, Atzeluth, which contains this one sphere of limitless light that emanates from this one monad, Kether. And that's where the undifferentiated God force starts off, up there. And then it radiates down into the next dimension, which is referred to as Bria, and this is a sort of a two-stroke engine. This is it should be the realm of the fixed stars, the realm of the original monad that personifies itself, and then the realm of the fixed stars. Sort of a yin-yang proposition, a two-stroke engine, if you will. And then the third dimension down below that, which has the rest of the spheres, excluding Malkuth, that's the astral plane, or the zero dimension, the formative world. And this is where all the pagan archetypes and the angels and all the rest of them, and all the spirits and these creative worlds and realms of the imagination live. And then, finally, down below is the physical world, Malkuth, where we are, and where things come into physical manifestation. Now, one of the things that about the Kabbalah is that it is a development from Greek philosophy, filtered through this Merkava mysticism idea of the Jews. But it's essentially Platonic and Neoplatonic in the sense that you have these descending emanations that come down through these spheres. And as they come down, they become more differentiated, and they become more specific, and they become more divergent and more complex until finally they get down to the bottom and you're in the physical world. Obviously, if you can manipulate this within yourself and in the greater universe, and the Kabbalah shares with Hermetic philosophy, it shares the idea that as above, so below. They have the Jewish Kabbalah has the idea of the Adam Kadmon, the cosmic man, so to speak. The same thing, and this derives, as I said, from Greek Hermetic and Orphic philosophy, and the idea being that you can use these formulas, these Kabbalistic formulas, to actually influence these spheres both within yourself and in the greater universe. So, I have a colleague and sometimes mentor and a colleague of mine, a very dear colleague, Lon Milo Duquette, who I think those of you who have seen Beyond Lemuria, you've seen him appear as Hermes Trismegistus up on top of the mountain. Lon has written a wonderful little book on Hermetic Kabbalah, which I heartily recommend, and it's called The Chicken Kabbalah of Rabbi Lamed Ben Clifford. And of course, Rabbi Lamed Ben Clifford is a pen name or a pseudonym of the maestro Lon Duquette himself, but Rabbi Lamed Ben Clifford is a kind of a humorous rabbi who teaches Kabbalah and he says Kabbalah's for everybody. You know, this is really Hermetic Kabbalah. But Lon took an example from Plato and expanded on it, and I thought I'd go ahead and use it to sort of describe how the Tree of Life, the Kabbalistic emanation principle works. And it goes something like this, if I can do justice to Lon's interpretation of Plato. Anyway, way up in Atzeluth in the highest dimension, God emanates the word rest. And then down in Bria, the next dimension down, that creative dimension there, a couple of archangels turn around to each other, and one of them says to the other one, he says, hey, I think the boss wants a chair. And so they look down into the dimension below them, which is Yetzira, where all these people are down there on drawing boards and on computers, and they're all down there working, and the two angels, the managers up there in the top, and they shout down there, God wants a chair. So these guys down below, they all look up and say, okay, we'll get it on the drawing board, we'll put it on a computer, we'll get it on CAD CAM, we'll have chairs for you. So they're designing chairs. And then, down in Malkuth, that's down where we are, physical dimension, there's a showroom. And the chairs start coming down there and plopping down in the showroom. You can come in and buy them, the real chairs. Now, that's the way the four dimensions work. And, of course, conversely, if they're within you and they're out there and all that, you can go and have a chair made. Yeah, and all you got to do is just know the right formulas, and away you go. Now, that's a real, you know, check that out. That's Lon Milo Duquette's The Chicken Kabbalah of Rabbi Lamed Ben Clifford. You can buy that one on Amazon for one click. Now, anyway, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to read a little bit out of my book, which you can also buy on Amazon for one click, and that's The Book of Solomon's Magic. And I have a chapter in here called The Kabbalah of Wizardry. I want to read you just a little bit of this because I tried in the Book of Solomon's Magic to make Kabbalah a little more easy to understand. And I started off this way. Remember, as above, so below, as within, so without. Now, at this point, you might be wondering how we can, as mere mortals, presume to invoke archangels and evoke ancient gods, goddesses, and demon kings. Even though we have the essential operative secrets, hypnosis, the mirror reflection phenomenon, and the aura-producing crystal. But where do we get the special knowledge, the philosophy, and the empowerment to use these methods in magical operations? Well, the philosophy behind Solomon's magic is Kabbalah. In magic, the Kabbalistic mindset is as important as the hypnotic operative technique. If hypnosis is the tactic of the wizard, then Kabbalah is his strategy. I got that, Harry Potter? About this, there is comforting news and there is challenging news. The challenging news is that you cannot escape learning the basics of Kabbalah. And the comforting news is that you don't need to read Hebrew any better than some Tibetan lamas can read Sanskrit. And they're still excellent magicians. Besides that, we convert all Hebrew into Phoenician anyway. So you know, you can, if somebody asks you, do you read Hebrew? No, I read Phoenician. Please understand that I don't propose to teach you Kabbalah in this book. Well, I don't really. This short chapter merely sets forth the special characteristics of our version of Kabbalah, and you can familiarize yourself with the grand old system and the works I've recommended in the study guide. Well, I recommended one of them, and that's Juan Duquette's Chicken Kabbalah of Rabbi Lamed Ben Clifford, and I want you to get that one. With this in mind, let's look briefly at what we call the Kabbalah of Wizardry. It was developed in the late Middle Ages and early Renaissance by nominally Christian magicians, nominally, and is usually referred to as the Hermetic Kabbalah. It differs from Rabbinical Kabbalah, and it is somewhat pagan and Gnostic. How Judeo-Christian really is it? Now, these questions may not seem important at this point, but they will loom large as you begin a serious study of the subject. So I will do my best to answer them as briefly and as simply as I can right at the outset. Let's begin by attempting, and this is something that you really want to pay close attention to. Let's begin by attempting a one-sentence definition of Kabbalah. Boy, if I can do this, I ought to get a Pulitzer Prize. Okay, here we go. Kabbalah is a philosophical, mathematical, geometric system that describes the creation and operation of the universe through four dimensions by employing a schematic design containing 10 spheres of descending emanations connected by 22 paths attributed to letters of the alphabet and their numerical equivalents. Okay? Well, this is a starting point, but it's not much better than giving the weight, height, and color as a definition for an elephant. Now, essential to understanding Kabbalah is the concept of Ein Sof, the limitless nothing. It contracts into itself and produces the Ein Sof Aur, the limitless light, which then expands to produce the universe and continues to enliven and to ensoul it. Now, this conception predates modern physics' The Big Bang Theory by 1,000 years. It also puts Kabbalistic philosophy in a very controversial position in relation to Orthodox Jewish and Christian religion. At the highest level the Kabbalist can conceive, God is not judgmental or in any way dissatisfied with his creation. He simply is. And continues to be. A contemporary popular analogy would be the Force in the Lucas Star Wars films. Now, the universe is therefore operated by lesser, more differentiated personifications such as angels, gods, goddesses, and elemental spirits. Now, this idea was originally Neoplatonic, the philosophical high watermark of classical paganism, and can be explored further in the writings of the philosopher Plotinus and his followers, the Epicurus and Porphyry and all the rest of them. And we also, I think we ought to mention Empedocles too, because he came before Plotinus and he had a lot to do. He was the fellow that came up with the idea of the four elements, air, earth, fire, water, love and strife. That was the whole universe, according to Empedocles. Now, we attribute all of these lesser powers to the various spheres and paths of the tree of life structure described in our one-sentence definition that we just gave you. Now, we can then access them for knowledge or for help. Now, thinking of it in a more subjective way, we might say that Kabbalah is a spiritual magical computer program for your mind. It interfaces the left and right hemispheres of the brain, a modern psychological reality originally theorized by the Kabbalist Isaac Luria in the 16th century. But I have to mention that he got him reversed, but he did theorize it, and that was pretty good. And it allows you to go online with the great mainframe, in other words, the macrocosm. And you are the microcosm, and you access the macrocosm, God. Now, since its emergence in medieval southern France and Spain to the present era, Kabbalah, especially magical Kabbalah, has been studied and practiced by as many Gentiles as Jews. Now, in the 15th century, Europe, a philosophical marriage took place that established the lineage of the Western esoteric tradition. Hebrew Kabbalah was united with classical paganism, Hermeticism, and Hermetic philosophy had arisen, of course, in the 2nd century, the Christian era, as an attempt to preserve the ancient wisdom from the intellectual onslaught of Christian zealots. It combined elements of Neoplatonic, Gnostic, and Orphic teachings. And when the Hermetic writings were rediscovered by Renaissance Europeans, magic was literally reborn. Hebrew Kabbalah, which shared many of the same original roots, was soon integrated into the Hermetic scheme, and it gave it a necessary structure. Now, you know, if you wanted a real education in the Middle Ages, you went to Spain. All over Europe, that's where you went. And down there, the Arabs and the Jews and the Christians all taught together in the universities, and they had courses in magic, and they had courses in magical astrology, and that was where you went, was down to the University of Saragossa and Cordoba. Humanist Hermetic philosophers enriched their magical art by including the pagan Orphic hymns to the gods and drawing on the exotic Arabian-Sabaean planetary magical system, having origins in ancient Canaan and Babylon, to create an elegant synthesis. The earth was declared a goddess, the anima mundi, and deified, and the sun was deified. The moon and the planets were evoked both in the human body and in the heavens beyond. And this obviously pagan, capricious, and amoral pantheon was balanced and regulated by angelic counterparts retained from the biblical system. However, in the Hermetic Kabbalah, these angels were thought of as the sentient messengers or special power givers, not of a biblical Jehovah, but of an omnipresent, omnipotent, and non-judgmental force that flowed throughout the universe. The famous Renaissance philosopher-magician Giordano Bruno, who was supposedly burned at the stake for supporting Copernicus's heliocentric theory, was actually executed by the Inquisition, not because he publicly declared that, yes, the earth does revolve around the sun. No, that wasn't why they killed him, but because he insisted that the sun is a god. Now, Kabbalah in its earliest form was probably derived from a synthesis of Pythagorean mathematical geometric philosophy and Simonian or Samaritan Gnosticism in the first century. That's the outgrowth from Merkava mysticism and Simon Magus. Simon Magus, by the way, was a Samaritan. Palestine and Alexandria, its Palestinian roots are shrouded in myth, but we can make an argument for a pagan Samaritan origin through Simon Magus. In its later Hermetic form, the practical magical Kabbalah is similar to Tibetan Tantric Buddhism. In that, elaborate visualizations of frankly pagan god forms, angels, and elemental spirits are encouraged, Judaic and Muslim religious tradition forbids this imagery, thus severely handicapping their forms of Kabbalah. There is, however, one major difference between our Hermetic system and that of the Tantrics. They contend that everything is ultimately illusion, whereas we say that everything is ultimately reality. And for this reason, we place great emphasis on developing and balancing the four philosophical elements, fire, air, water, and earth, animated by the force, which we call spirit. Remember Empedocles, air, earth, fire, water, love, and strife. In Hermetic Kabbalistic terms, these four elements are the manifestation of the Tetragrammaton, the fourfold name of God. And they are further personified by the four archangels of the quarters, which you're already familiar with. Now, the importance of these four magical elements, which were also the Grail Hallows of the Tarot Suits, cannot be overemphasized. I need not press my argument further than to refer the student to one of our major beginning texts, Initiation into Hermetics by Franz Barden. Now, this entire work is devoted to the mastery of these four elements. Hermetic Kabbalah also employs angelic balancing forces as invoking and evoking formulas to call down and summon up its otherwise pagan entities. Now, there should be no disrespect or irreverence toward ancient deities in this process. It is the traditional source of the magician's power. The arts of theurgy and thaumaturgy allow you to explore vast dream realms and discover lost treasures of spirit. One might say that the worshipping mystic waits on the whim of his god while the magician sets out to climb Mount Olympus. If you are a spiritual adventurer, the respectful manipulation of these forces will be the appropriate method for you. You now have a beginning idea of what Hermetic Kabbalah is about, but you may still wonder how it differs from traditional Jewish Kabbalah. Well, it differs in three ways. First, Jewish Kabbalah is primarily concerned with decoding the first five books of the Bible via the process of gematria. Now, this means each Hebrew letter has a number value, and hence any other word adding up to the same value has a mystic relation or could be a coded substitution. Second, Jewish Kabbalah, of the most esoteric Lurianic school, does postulate a non-judgmental God force at the highest level, but becomes highly moralistic in descending levels. And third, Jewish Kabbalah has nothing to do with the Tarot or any pagan God forms on the Tree of Life. Now, by the 18th century, the Jewish intellectual establishment had generally abandoned Kabbalah as a baleful influence on their culture. Although, in recent years, there has been a revival of interest in the subject in the Jewish community, especially in the 1960s and 70s, when the rabbis discovered that some of their brightest young people were attracted to esoteric Buddhism. This gave Gershom Shalom a shot in the arm. This historical background is mentioned so that the reader will be aware that there are two distinctly different conceptions and philosophies of Kabbalah. There is no official Kabbalah. There is only the Kabbalah that's right for you. Now, we should also mention that our particular OTA version of Hermetic Kabbalah uses Phoenician letters, as I said, instead of Hebrew. And the Phoenician alphabet appendix, of course, in Solomon's Magic will give you all of that. And we use a non-Judaic tetragrammaton in lieu of YHVH. I mentioned that last week when we got into the discussion on Hermetic yoga on that, and I'll go over it again. YHVH, the four-letter tetragrammaton, really didn't come into use until the Bahir in medieval Spain. It wasn't in the Sefer Yetzirah originally. The Sefer Yetzirah had Yah and it used Yaha only to seal the cube of space. It was not the creative tetragrammaton. The creative tetragrammaton in the Sefer Yetzirah originally was a left mem and shin, and which centered in Tau, in the center of the cube of space. The Tau was Saturn, and that was the beginning of the physical universe. So what we did in our Hermetic Kabbalah and the OTA, I think I mentioned last week the experience we had where we had a dozen or so Sephardic Jewish folks out to one of our seasonals. We were having a grand time. We were all getting along real good, and everybody, we were having a terrific time until the deacon came out in the end of the ceremony and cut loose with and these guys just marched out. They just marched right out of the gate and they were gone. They didn't even say goodbye. And I got to thinking about that when we carried on the ceremony, of course, but I got to thinking, I said, hey, we stole their God. And we shouldn't do that. I mean, this is the Hermetic Kabbalah. This is, and I'm Hermetic. I'm not Christian. I'm not Jewish. And what are we doing stealing their God? So I began to really, really take a serious look at the Kabbalistic structure and realized that Lef Mem and Shin, the three mother letters of the elements, and Tau, that's the creative tetragrammaton. And then, of course, we developed another one, Amashaol, which is we added a letter to the Hebrew alphabet, Omega past Tau, to the Phoenician alphabet, which filled us in with 28 letters, and that gave us an analog to the zodiac, which 22 letters won't do. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, one of the progenitors of the Kabbalah was Valentinian Gnosticism, especially of Marcus. And he developed a direct analog of the Greek letters to the zodiac. So we developed a tetragrammaton for a 28-letter alphabet, which is Amasha'o, and then Shema'atah for the 22-letter alphabet. So you don't really need YHVH, although you can do some wonderful gematria with it. I'm not saying you can't. And if you're more Jewish Christian oriented, you should probably use it. Now I have a note here in the book about where Jesus fits into all of this, he doesn't too well because we have 10 spheres and we can put him in Tiphereth. Obviously, that's where he would go. But the best thing to do with Jesus, if you're a Christian and you want to do this, and we have Christians, we have Christians in our order, and they just kind of, they say, well, we'll do this. They're very eclectic. But the best thing to do is keep Jesus in his own realm. The best thing is just not try to stick him into the Kabbalah, because if you do, he's not going to be comfortable there. And I have a lot of respect for Jesus. I think his teachings are wonderful. And I don't think, my feeling is that he's just not comfortable there. So you keep him, if you want to, take him up and put him up in Berea somewhere or something like that. If you want to do that, it doesn't work with Kabbalistic theory. By the way, one of the things I will mention at this point, because the Kabbalah is, even the Lurianic Kabbalah, is so non-judgmental at the higher levels, and because it does postulate a universe which, as I say, was originally developed by Empedocles, and that's air, earth, fire, water, love, and strife. That's everything. And so you, having a judgmental God at the highest level is just not going to work with the Kabbalistic theory. So supposedly the old rabbis would not take on a student of Kabbalah unless he was pretty close to 40 years old, married, had children, and was established in the community. Then they would consider teaching him this because it was somewhat of an amoral philosophy. At this point, I'm going to discuss the Phoenician gods on the tree, to sort of give you an idea of how that works. So, down at the bottom, at Malkuth, we put Gaia, the earth goddess, and then up at Yasod, where the moon, that's the sphere of the moon, and that's also the beginning of the astral plane, we have the moon goddess Tanit, and we also have the dragon of chaos, Lotan. And then over in Hod, that's Mercury, and that's in our yoga system, that would be right below the belly button, but in the tree of life, it's number 8 on the tree of life in Yetzira, in the astral dimension. And there's where we put Kusor, the blacksmith, who is also Tubal Cain, the biblical Tubal Cain. And then over in Netzach, we place Astarte, of course, in Netzach at Venus. And by the way, I want to point out that these, don't let anybody tell you that these spheres are not derived from the planets, because they are. And don't let anybody tell you that astrology does not have a very, very strong influence on the Kabbalah, because it does. This is so obvious when you read the Zohar. I mean, so Astarte is over in Venus in Netzach, and in our way of looking at things, she is the great fertility goddess, the great goddess of the physical universe and all of its generative and nurturing factors. And in fact, we see her as a sort of like the Tibetans see Tara. Now, in Tipperath, where you might put Jesus if you find him comfortable there, we have Baal, and we also have his brother Mot. His brother Mot is the god of death, of course. So we have the two of them there, and Baal is the god that dies every year, of course, and comes back. Now, over in Gabura, which is over here in the Pillar of Severity, there we have the war goddess Anath. And Gabura is a feminine sphere anyway. So we have the war goddess Anath, and that, if you recall from Prince of Cotton, the Magic Bow, she was the precursor of Astarte, and she is very, very severe. She's the warrior goddess. Over at Hesed, we place Dagon, the fish god, represented by Capricorn and Oannes, the great teacher. And that's Jupiter, of course, and that would be your third eye in the yoga system. And then, above that, right up to where Yetzira, where the formative dimension goes into the higher dimension of Bria, there's the so-called hypothetical sphere of Da'ath. Now, what we've done in the Inner Order, the Golden Dawn did something similar, and we in the Inner Order, we establish an 11-sphere tree. This is the tree before the fall. And that, when we do that, Da'ath becomes Saturn, and that's the gateway into the higher dimension. And when that happens, Kether, way up top, and that's aloof, and is no longer one, that's zero, and then one goes down to Hokmont Bria, and that's Father El, by the way. We put IAO, you know, which is the Gnostic idea of the highest God. And then we put Father El, who was the Canaanite the version of what the Jews would call Jehovah. Then Father El is in Hokmah, and then over in Bina, in the Briatic dimension, we put Asherat of the Sea, the mother, great mother goddess, who is equal to El in our system. And this is more appropriate because this makes the realm of the fixed stars in Bria, where it ought to be. And then down to Saturn, and we're in the Da'ath position, And, of course, the numbering remains the same. This works out much, much better for Magic, and it also gives you a gateway. It gives you a gateway into higher dimensions. You know, they said in the Sefer Yetzirah that there's only 10, and there's just 10, and there's no more than 10, no less than 10. Well, actually, Isaac Gloria and the Golden Dawn and Horus, we don't go along with that. We've got 11 because you need to have a gateway. Now, let's talk about this a little bit. So, Kepler up here at zero would be the primum mobile, and then over Chokmah is the Logos or Chronos, and that's the left brain. I remember Gloria got him mixed up, but he was on the right track. That's the left brain, and then Bina, which is the realm of the fixed stars, the Soma Sophia, and that's the right brain, and then Da'ath, Saturn, and that's the corpus callosum in the brain, and then as said, is Jupiter is the pituitary and the pineal glands, and Gabura is Anath in the throat, and so we manifest in that respect. Now, let's see here. How much time we have left? How much time do we have left? 10? We got 10 minutes left? Well, if we got 10 minutes left, I am going to, at this point, I think that we'll discuss what's going to go on next week. Now, we haven't been taking any calls. We've tried to take a few, but we've been covering an awful lot of material in these broadcasts. And, you know, they're all archived, and you can access them and catch up on them and whatever. Next week we're going to get really interactive. And next week, be sure and try to be here live, because what we're going to do is we're going to take calls. And we'll take your questions on any of the topics we've covered since we started the program. So anything that you've been wondering about and that you want to ask about, try to keep it brief and try to keep it specific. And if you don't, I will get you specific if I can. And let's have an interactive evening, and we'll discuss these things that you may be wondering about, because I've thrown a lot of material at you. And I know some of it is certainly controversial if you're into any of this material, which I assume a number of you are, and we'd like to hear from you. So next week will be our interactive week, and then we're going to try from the future episodes, we're going to have people, you know, specific people calling in, people of, you know, other authors and other experts, and what's an expert? An ex is a has-been, and a spurt's a turf under pressure. But we'll have some people that are a little bit better at that, and they'll call in, and you'll have a chance to sort of kick some of these ideas around. And I think so mark that down. Next week is going to be the interactive session. And at that point, let me see, how much time do I have left? And I've got a little bit of time left. So if I've got a little bit of time left, I think what I will do is I will end up by, let's see here. I will end up with reading the last part of this chapter that I was just reading you here. And this brief theoretical explanation raises as many questions as it answers. We're at least off to a good start. Now let's take a quick look at the practical Kabbalistic aspects of a goetic operation. After opening the lunar gate, you saw it with a planetary septagram ritual, during which you will internally expand the tree of life in Yasod, located in the genital chakra, to displace and overlay the other psychic centers in your body. You will then circumambulate your magic circle deicil as many turns as the number of the sephirah you are working. For example, seven times for the Spirit Netzach. Likewise, in a Yesod Netzach operation, you will use green candles and burn sandalwood incense. The names of power that you plug into your standard conjuration are drawn from our Master Mandala and the 777 references to the sphere of your working, and you will also use the proper planetary metal, or an affordable facsimile, for the spiritual amend worn by the receiver. And as you can see, there is a psychotechnical structure to Solomon's magic that is definitely Kabbalistic. This does not mean that you have to master all the theoretical principles and practical methods of this venerable philosophy before you venture into wizardry. You got that, Harry Potter? Okay, the fact is that you will never master it all. One of the more important things you will learn from the study of Kabbalah and the practice of magic is the vast extent of what you really do not know. And the more you study and practice, and the greater and the deeper and the further this unknowing will extend. So remember this when someone tries to tell you how much they know or how much you do not know about Kabbalah. And on that point, I believe that we are just about out of time. I will see you next week, and I'll be talking with you folks next week, and we'll see if we can answer any of your questions that you have about the material we've covered. So, good evening and good magic.